Welcome to Journey's Fire, a weekly program for the visionary and the passionate soul on a mission. I'm Richard Brendan, professional speaker, life purpose coach, counselor, and former hospice chaplain. My purpose in life is to inspire the fire that burns within you and reawaken your heart for love, life, and work. Each week, I'll be bringing you engaging conversations with today's visionary leaders and social change artists. I believe that true fulfillment begins when we say yes to our dreams and take bold and inspired action to design the lives we are created for. Are you ready to live your best life? Well, Journey's Fire begins now. Of the 918 Americans who died in the shocking murder-suicides of November 18, 1978, in the tiny South American country of Guyana, a third were under 18. More than half were in their 20s or younger. Well, in a new book, And Then They Were Gone, Teenagers of People's Temple from High School to Jonestown begins in San Francisco at the small school where Reverend Jim Jones enrolled the teens of his People's Temple Church in 1976. Within a year, most had been sent to join Jones and other congregants in what Jones promised was a tropical paradise based on egalitarian values, but which turned out to be a deadly prison camp. Set against the turbulent backdrop of the late 1970s, the book And Then They Were Gone draws from interviews, books, and articles. Many of these powerful stories were told for the first time in this book. There are so many important lessons we can learn from this book for today, which is why I've invited the author Judy Bibelar to come on the program. Judy taught in San Francisco public high schools for 37 years. Her students have won many prizes, including 6 national Scholastic Writing Awards. Scholastic also awarded her the White House Women's Leadership and Teaching Award in 2002. And in 1996, she was selected as one of the 8 English teachers across America that State Farm gave the Good Neighbor Award to. Bibelar was one of the founders of Opportunity 1 and 2, alternative San Francisco public high schools, and is a teacher consultant with UC Berkeley's Bay Area Writing Projects. And it's from the beautiful area of Berkeley, California, that she joins me today. Judy Bibelar, thank you so much for sharing your time with me today.
Thank you, Richard.
When the publicist sent me this book, I was surprised because it was about something that I still remember where I was when I heard the news on the radio and it was unfolding. And each time another report came on, more and more people were pronounced dead. Mm-hmm. And that was back in 1978.
Yeah.
To where
that's unusual for somebody from back east. People here, mostly, who were aware then, they remember.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet they do. And funny thing is, I grew up in central Indiana. At the time, though, I didn't know about Reverend Jim Jones, who was a pastor in the Discipleship Church here in Indianapolis.
I know. That's where it all began.
Yeah. Yeah, and you were involved with these kids at the school in San Francisco. I guess my first question is this, though, because of this story, which to me is so powerful, and we have since seen a lot of documentaries and things like that on TV. Some of the students that I work with here, of course, have not heard of Jonestown, but they haven't heard of John Mellencamp either. So, you know, that's okay. What inspired you, Judy, to write this book, especially since it was 40 years after?
Well, it was really hard to know at first, and you're right. It wasn't until December that the names of people came out in the San Francisco Chronicle, and even then, that wasn't all of the names, but we found way too many of our students on the list. But I just couldn't think of anything. I think all of us in the Bay Area were kind of devastated. Herb Cain, a columnist that was very popular here, called it a gray day. And then 10 days later, our mayor, Moscone, and Harvey Milk, a city council member, were assassinated in City Hall. So it really seems like the whole world was wrong and going in the wrong direction. And how could all these kids have died? But in 2006, there was a play called The People's Temple with an apostrophe. Lee Fondakowski, who put the play together from actual words of people in Jonestown. There's a repository here of the California Historical Society of all the papers of the temple. And she put the apostrophe in the People's Temple because she wanted to show that her play was about the people of the temple, the one that belonged to them, not Jim Jones' temple. And Ron called me up, Ron Cabral, my co-author, and said, Judy, have you seen this play? And I said, no, but I will in just a couple of days. I have tickets. And he said, I think we could do something like that for our kids. And because it was very respectful of the people, very using their words as much as possible, which we also try to do in the book. So that's kind of what got us going. And then 13 years later, finally, we got it out. But we were lucky in that it was just in time for the 40th anniversary of Jonestown. And who knew that was going to be the biggest one yet, with the most articles and documentaries coming out just before, and a big article in the San Francisco Chronicle about Ron and me and the kids.
Yes. This book is well done. It's won numerous awards, but I'm also guessing because of what happened there and for our young people today, that there are cautionary lessons they can take from the People's Temple students that you taught regarding authoritarian figures, because we're seeing them today as well.
Yes, and I hope they do. Stephen Jones, who is Jim Jones' only biological son, who is one of the survivors because the kids were away at a basketball tournament in Georgetown, the capital of Guyana, when Jim Jones ordered them to come home, but they didn't, thinking he's just doing that awful thing where he scares people again. But what he speaks about to young people a lot is peer pressure, and to be careful of peer pressure, that it can lead you astray. And he said he himself sometimes would be sitting in the pews of the church and thinking, this doesn't seem right. But he'd look around, and here are all these people that he'd known all his life and loved, and they weren't saying anything and seemed to be going along with it. And he thought, well, you know, maybe I'm wrong. And I think it's easy, especially for young people, to do that. And the kids we knew at the school were obeying the rules, like not to talk to us too much about their personal lives. And but being kids, they also broke rules. And he said, don't have too much to do with the other kids. Well, there were at least two of what I call Romeo and Juliet couples, where a temple kid and a non-temple kid got together, but they would meet secretly in the darkened art room when no one was there so that none of the other kids would know what was going on. So it's they didn't just follow along, and they didn't in Jonestown either.
You shared that one of your students was actually warned earlier by Maya Angelou, who spoke at the school. Her name was Linda, who was at the time, and seeing her looking exhausted in a class at Washington High, which many of our students attended, you said, before Jones sent all the teens to Opportunity School, Angelou said to Linda, whatever you're into right now, it's not good for you, and you should get out of it.
Yes. And so, there was a nurse there that saw that too and let her sleep in the nurse's office when she knew she was really tired. And Linda ended up running away from the church, and before she was sent to Jonestown, because another temple member broke the rules and told her, Linda, he's going to try to send you before you turn 18 to Jonestown. So she ran away, and that's an interesting story in the book, I think. And now she's my friend.
And, And thank God she ran away.
Yes. Yeah. And Ron noticed she was in his class, not mine. Mm-hmm. And Ron noticed her coming in with some bruises. And he asked her about it, and she said, oh, I was just fooling around. Mm-hmm. But he suspected it might be something more and reported it to the principal. Yeah. The law that teachers had to report things like that had just been passed. Mm-hmm. And the principal said she'd take care of it. But I think she thought that anything, you know, that Jones wouldn't possibly do anything wrong. And if he did, he had reasons. And so nothing was done about it. But thank goodness Linda escaped. Mm-hmm. And I think also when the kids came to Opportunity, we didn't notice too much about them from, except that they didn't open up like the other kids, for two reasons. One, I think they were pretty happy being in the relatively free atmosphere of our little school, where lots of interesting things and trips and teachers doing, taking them on walks around the city and going to plays and, you know, they were having a good time. The boys in the temple made Ron's first baseball team possible. Mm-hmm. He had tried and tried, but couldn't get the kids to show up and didn't have enough good athletes. So one was that freedom. And the other reason was I think probably Jones made sure that the kids looked good. One teacher remembered they always had their little brown bag lunches with them. Mm-hmm. Because he wanted them to appear good to our staff, and he knew it was a smaller school where things would be noticed. But that's just my guess. I don't know that for sure.
Since the People's Temple students you taught saw the world in a non-racist, egalitarian way, as well as being idealistic and good students, what positive messages can the young people learn from them?
Well, I think it's their courage. Mm-hmm. Their resilience. There's a phrase that another Jonestown writer, Deborah Layton, who escaped from Jonestown to try to prevent the tragedy, and obviously she couldn't, even though she gave press releases and went around and talked to people, but wrote a book, Seductive Poison. And the phrase she uses that is the name of chapter 12 in my book is precious acts of treason, because people took chances for other people out of love or friendship.
Yeah.
And in Jonestown, doing a simple thing like saying, I don't want to be here anymore. I'd really like to go home. That could get you in huge trouble. Or saying you're afraid of something could get you in huge trouble.
Yeah.
In her case, her mother stuffed she was dying actually of cancer and thought Jones could cure her. And she had some medications and pain medication. And the woman who was inspecting her bag in Jonestown, as all bags were inspected, saw the medication. And instead of pulling them out like she was supposed to, she just tucked it down farther into the bag. So she knew that Deborah's mom would probably need those pills. And then Chapter 12 is all about the things that kids did, partly just insisting on being themselves and flirting and falling in love and doing the things that young people do, but sometimes taking big chances, including the very biggest one, I think, was Monica Bagby was one of our students, and she and a friend, Vern Gosney, when the congressman, Leo Ryan, visited because he wanted to see if it was true that people were being held there against his will, and came with a lot of reporters and relatives of people there. I forgot where I was going.
You were talking about the note that they slipped to one of the reporters.
Oh, the note.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
They were brave enough to slip a reporter a note. And if things had gone otherwise, that might have been really, really dangerous for them. And they could have been, punishments were horrible in Jonestown.
Yeah.
You know, really inhuman.
Well, and Monica actually was badly wounded, too, when they shot everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
she and Vern survived.
Uh-huh.
He was wounded as well.
Okay.
But she died way too early. I don't even know where she was. I think she had disappeared out under the streets because she was very paranoid, as you would mm-hmm. expect
mm-hmm.
from
mm-hmm.
being in that situation so long. She never wanted to go to Jonestown. Her mother insisted on it, and then she hated it there.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure she must have felt some kind of responsibility, too, even though it was great that she did what she did, but then everybody died. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think what has floored everybody, and to this day, those of us who've been aware of it, you know, how could 918 Americans die in a murder-suicide simply of the command of a reverend? And I guess my question is, why was it easy for Jim Jones to get hundreds of people to go with him to Guyana and give up their lives in the United States?
Well, most of them had, in a way, given up everything to the church already.
Yeah.
Because they had signed over their, many of them were homeowners, and some had Social Security checks coming in, and they signed it over to the church.
Mm-hmm.
And he had convinced them that they were all going to go to this tropical paradise and build a model society without ageism, racism, or sexism, and they were going to get to be part of this. The old people would be well taken care of. The other, middle-aged people were mm-hmm. eager to help build this model society and had a lot of the skills to build something in the middle of the jungle. And the kids were really excited about it, and it was an adventure.
Yeah.
And why they came so many all at once mm-hmm. was because news came out mm-hmm. in a magazine called The New West in San Francisco about the terrible things that were going on behind closed church doors. And so he just shipped them out really quickly, which was one reason for the terrible crowded conditions and the eventual, lack of good food.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they were there, the first thing that happened was their passports were taken away. And then by 1977, when most of our kids arrived in the spring and that summer, it was really a jungle prison camp, and they knew it would be really, really difficult. They'd have to risk their lives
mm-hmm.
to try to escape through the very thick bush, and he had them convinced that the Guyanese army would shoot them if his own security guards didn't kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't mm-hmm. have much choice about, and he had them convinced that the whole world hated them. Even Russia mm-hmm. hated them and wouldn't accept them, so there was nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the enemies of the church, by which he meant the people who had defected from the church, and there were many of those, would come and kill them.
Yeah.
And of course, that's not what they did. They came to try to rescue people, the parents and sisters and brothers that wanted to get their loved ones home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by the time they were in Guyana, and they were there for a while, and it truly ended up being a jungle prison camp, and passports were seized. Jim Jones, he pretty much had some assistants carrying guns at that time, I think. So it was much more than just a charismatic preacher in his oratory, you know, leading them into this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was quite a while until he even realized that there were guns in Jonestown. It's just when the pressure started getting greater and greater on mm-hmm. Jones, he had a son of a church member who was a defector there with him that he claimed was his own son. And the parents, even though one wasn't a defector and one was, they mm-hmm. were trying to sue to get him back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing that was weighing down on him. And the more he became paranoid, the more strictures were greater on the people there.
Yeah.
And they were worked really hard, punished really hard.
Uh-huh.
They were exhausted. And,
yeah.
In the jungle, you can catch lots of things And it's not so easy to cure them. And the only doctor they had was kind of a fake doctor. So, mm-hmm.
The students you taught, Judy, they were members of People's Temple. Did they like People's Temple, or were they forced to go to Guyana by their parents?
Well, many of them came with their parents from Indiana in 1965.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, like Linda says, that being in a church was one of the best parts of her life until it got awful. And that she, because it was like a big family. I thought of going to the church and bringing my daughter, because when I found out, oh, you know what they do, honey? They just move aside the chairs. They don't have pews. And everybody dances and they sing a lot. And when Jones came and spoke at the school, he talked about the rough deal that Eve had received in the Bible, everything blamed on her. Mm-hmm. He really knew how to talk a good talk.
Yeah.
He knew how to charm people. And like all of us, he was a mixture.
Yes.
No, he wasn't totally evil.
Yes.
Although I think as he got sicker and crazier and more afraid, he tended more towards that side until finally he decided they all must die.
And it seems so often in history that's what happens, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Somebody who starts off, perhaps, I know in Indianapolis, he was doing some good things for the poor and, and helping people, and he was charismatic. He knew how to charm people. That's probably a good word to use.
Yeah.
And so he gained their trust.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Like Deborah Layton's mother was a very intelligent, educated woman who'd escaped from Nazi Germany, and yet she believed that Jones could cure her cancer.
Wow.
Which, when you have cancer, I can understand. You want to believe somebody can fix it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I first heard about all this, and then it came out, and we knew the story, you mentioned her being from concentrator from Germany. I couldn't help but think of Hitler.
Yeah.
And how he was as a young man and what caused all of that to happen in Germany. Right time, right place. And
enough people that would go along with the plan.
Exactly. Exactly. Do you also think that the people just in their hearts really wanted to believe Jones, and so the signs that probably were there were just missed or ignored?
Well, I'm sure that there was, as I said, there were a lot of defectors who left the church, starting way back in 1973 with a group of young people that were students at Santa Rosa College when Jones had moved the church up to the Redwood Valley there.
Yeah.
And they wrote a statement about why they were defecting and what was wrong with the church, and it was shortly after that, the October of 1973, Jones started the plans for building this mission outpost in Guyana, because I think he realized there could be more and more than there were many in San Francisco. But like both of Linda's parents were defectors, her mother wrote a book called 6 Years with God about the things that were wrong with the church, and more people were, I think, again, it's not like they all felt wonderful when they were in church and thought that everything Jones did was great. Maybe some of the older people more, you know, because they really thought of him as a savior. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure people had doubts and misgivings, and I know some of the survivors talk about that. Mm-hmm. But then there were all the people they loved, you know, their families and good friends.
Yes, because they gave up their lives for this church. Yes. That was their family.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are the lessons, or some lessons, that we should all learn from Jonestown so that it doesn't, the horror doesn't repeat itself?
Well, I think that it's that idealism and that courage that I talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little piece of the book I'd like to read to you. A lot of Stephen Jones' writing is in the book because he's just a wonderful, gifted writer. And his writing can be found on the Jonestown Institute website. alternative considerations of Jonestown and People's Temple.
Okay.
But this has been one of those pieces. Stephen speaking. We were getting exhausted. Dad had pushed us all to the edge one too many times. It was time to stop playing the waiting game, waiting for the right reason, the right moment to rise up against him, waiting for his key supporters to see the light, waiting for him to get too sick, too strung out to lead, waiting for him to die. We had to do something about Dad and his leadership circle. Soon, we would retrace our three-day journey across hellish ocean, heavenly river, and dusty, tortured road. And now he's talking about coming back from the basketball tournament.
Yeah.
I told myself that when my new allies, because he and the other boys on the team were able to speak freely to one another and started even making fun of Jones while they were there and thinking, this is all crazy. So when I got back to Jonestown, he said, he told himself, my father's days were numbered. So if time had just been a little different, things had happened a little bit differently, you know, they probably would have done something to topple Jones.
Yeah.
And
eventually, yes.
And Tim, Stephen's adopted brother, he knew it had to be pretty soon, I think, that. But Tim believed that they could have done something, that they should have killed him. And Tim just died very recently, too. A really wonderful guy. But I think Jones, he's the one that people remember from the cover on Time magazine where he's holding his hat over his nose and identifying the dead.
Yeah.
And I think it was just all too much for him. And he died too young. I don't think he took good care of himself. And I think Stephen survived, and a lot of there are five other survivors I know that are writing books or have written books, and I think it's the people that spoke out, talked to other people about their experiences, tried to get the message out that when you think something is wrong, stop and check it out, and don't just go along with everybody around you if they seem to be going along with something. So I think that's a really important lesson. And then just their courage and their insistence on being themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I like what you wrote regarding that, lessons we can learn. You said, I'm thinking about how if we don't actively listen to and actively support the young, we won't have a true democracy or even a civilization to be proud of, perhaps even a livable world. The young I know from teaching high school for 37 years have ideals, have courage, have energy, but they also need mentors, knowledgeable, aware, kind mentors. Yeah, I would so agree with you on that.
Thank you for reading that. I forgot. I want to have a few things to share with Richard, but I didn't look at my own work.
Judy, when you reached out to your former students, what was the biggest surprise?
I don't know if I was so much surprised as just really gratified that both Temple and non-Temple kids were so eager to share their stories. That's how I learned about the Romeo and Juliet couple from one of the non-Temple kids, and to spend time with me, to come. Linda came here to meet with me twice, and I went up to meet with Stephen twice, and just so many people made that book happen. I mean, it wouldn't have happened without lots of friends and former students and fellow teachers and fellow writers who just pitched in to help make it happen.
Yeah, yeah. And in regarding the Temple, was it the New West expose when it came out with defectors' stories of terrible things going on behind the closed doors that really started to begin to open up people's eyes, including your own?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But when we went back to school, most of the Temple kids were gone.
So. Yeah. Can you elaborate on the poems and prose your students that went to Jonestown wrote?
Well, when you say poems, I mm-hmm. think of Joyce. She's the one on the cover of the book. She's in the bottom row and the very middle.
Yes.
And she just loved writing. And a lot of her poems were about this tropical paradise where she thought she was going to go and was going to live a beautiful life with her hair corn-rolled in the African way and wearing a beautiful dress and a big, proud smile on her face. And so hers really reveal that kind of idealism and belief that kids have. And then there was one student, Mondo. He was on the baseball team. And he wrote a poem about sitting in the dark, not being in the dark, all alone. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the poem, he says, "I didn't want to talk to myself because I was afraid someone might hear me." And at the time, I thought, you know, that's just a, you know, kind of a silly teenager thought. You know, he's making fun of himself. Mm-hmm. But now I know he was probably talking about how hard it was to always worry if somebody else was listening to you and might report you, and then you might get in trouble. And that father, as they all the kids called Jones, you know, would be angry at you and maybe have you punished in front of the church. Mm-hmm. So those are the two that I... Oh, and then wonderful Dorothy. And she wrote, I think a brother must have died before she came to California. So she wrote about a brother wanting my brother to come home, but he won't never come back, empty and dark like a cave. And it just makes me think of all the kids who died there in Jonestown.
Yeah.
The epigraph to the book, too, was a group poem by the kids in the creative writing class. And it almost sounds, when you read it, like they were somehow prescient. But nobody knew anything about how terrible Jones was or the terrible things going on inside of the church or, you know... But it talks about spirits of ancestors and mothers weeping for their children, and it just belongs there at the beginning of the book.
Yes. You've mentioned Jim Jones's son, Stephen, and you do have a relationship with him. How close are you? And also, I want to know, how influential was he while you were writing this book?
Oh, he was a huge help because he let me, as I said, use any of his wonderful writing. When I first started writing the book, I was doing it sort of as creative nonfiction, and I was going to, you know, imagine things about the kids from what I knew of them. And one of the things that I imagined was that usually when people came in the boat up the river for 8 hours, Stephen would go to pick them up in the little tractor trailer that they had to bring them over the bumpy, muddy road back to Jonestown for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And I imagined him smiling and waving and putting a little kid on his lap to let him help drive the tractor. And when I sent him that part, he said, "Judy, by the time those kids arrived in Jonestown, it was a jungle prison camp. And I didn't have a kid on my lap. I more likely had a gun by that time." Because by that time, Jones had them convinced that there were all these enemies out there to get them, and he staged people coming in and shooting, and then he'd bravely shoot back. That's when Stephen first discovered there were guns there, when his father shot out into the jungle.
I'm curious, how did Stephen heal himself to become the man he is now? Because that was his dad, and he witnessed so much at such a young age.
I know. And starting from, well, before adolescence, but it got really, you know, he really was saying things wrong with his father by the time he became an adolescent and was really troubled about it. And I think that's one reason I didn't get to know him very well back then, even though he was my counselee. And I also think that's why Jones chose him first in February of 77 to be sent to Jonestown. And he was told that he could come back in a week if he liked. But, of course, that wasn't true. But it was really good to have. That's when I decided, yes, this book has to have lots of footnotes. I have to make sure that everything is correct and accurate as I can.
Yes.
And Stephen had, you know, memories of those days. Those are in his reflections that were really helpful. I love the his story called Ruth's Teeth, which is one about one of Tim's sisters and her that she had this false teeth in front, and how the kids got together, I'm sure they weren't supposed to, led by Stephen, to rescue her teeth from the six-hole outhouse that everyone used. It's a funny story, the way Stephen writes it, but it also shows, well, they're going to help Ruth no matter what.
Considering that the Jonestown tragedy happened over four decades ago, what is one key message that you want people to learn from this book?
Well, I think Herb Cole, he's the educator and author.
Yes.
You probably have heard of his book, 36 Children.
Yes, I have. And he wrote the foreword.
Yes. And I'd like to read what he said, because I think he said it best. This book serves as an antidote to that forgetfulness. And earlier he's talked about how people tend to want to just forget things like this. By putting a face and giving voice to some of the victims, it teaches us how not to forget, but instead to bear witness to these interrupted lives and to honor them. And by doing so, to honor other victims of human aberrations and crimes. Perhaps in this way, we may be able to redeem some modicum of love, the driving force of what is best in ourselves, from the slew of despair created by so many terminated lives.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Judy Bibelar, I'm so glad you took this project on, that you're educating so many people who probably didn't even hear about Jonestown. And it is a clarion call, I think, on how we mentor and how we encourage and how we inspire our young people and their highest angels. The book is called And Then They Were Gone, Teenagers of People's Temple from High School to Jonestown. And Judy, can you give your web address, please?
It's just judybibelar.com, and if you just Google And Then They Were Gone, you will see my website and where you can buy the book on Amazon, and quite a few reviews, and they're right up there at the top.
Wonderful.
And Then They Were Gone. Thank you so much, Richard, for helping me to get the word out, because I do want lots of people to know about these kids and to, as you say, think about being mentors to the children in their life, and just being there for kids.
Once again, the title of the book is Then They Were Gone, Teenagers of People's Temple from High School to Jonestown. If you'd like more information on the book and the author, I encourage you to visit Judy Bibelar, BEBELAAR.com. And that is today's program. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I also want to thank my engineer, Kylan Talley, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire, inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.